Mr. Wallace, in the minds of a great many of our people, the greatest challenge facing our nation is a question of full employment. Even though we must all realize the reconversion period from war to peace is bound to cause dislocations, nevertheless, developments the past few weeks have made for additional concern. You, Mr. Secretary, in your interesting book, 60 Million Jobs, have awakened countless Americans to the seriousness of the challenge. We hope in this broadcast you will feel free to make any comments you wish on the subject of full employment as you apply it to our agricultural Midwest or to the nation as a whole, for of course it is a national problem. My own questions will deal largely with items suggested in your 60 million jobs. Perhaps as logical a way as any in which to open is to have you restate the goal as you see it.
In brief, we want continuous full employment without sacrificing free private enterprise.
Well, Mr. Wallace, how does the goal, that is approximately 60 million jobs by 1950, compare to the highest level of employment that we've known in the past?
Well, last year we had employment of about 64 million if we count in the boys in the armed services, and they were certainly employed. In peacetime, the biggest employment we ever had probably was in 1940, when I believe we had about 46 or 47 million. But at that time, there were 7 or 8 million unemployed. I think Mr. Dewey said there were 10 million unemployed. And, of course, by 1950, we'll have a substantially larger population than we had in 1940. In 60 million jobs in 1950 would be roughly the same proportion of the total population as the employment we had in 1929.
In other words, then, the goal certainly is not as out of reach as some people might have thought it to be when they first thought of it. Well, now, as to achieving that goal, just how does the challenge fit into the framework of our capitalistic system? Are we to understand that you believe we can achieve this end of the rainbow without substantial government assistance?
Well, Herb, I don't think we're going to achieve any end of the rainbow. I think the end of the rainbow will always be there, luring us on.
But we want to get as close to it as we can.
The all-important thing is to give businessmen the courage to invest. If we can give them incentive to invest, they'll do the vast part of the job. But in order that they may have courage to invest, it is essential in the economic storms that always come after a great war to give the businessmen assurance that if unemployment passes beyond a certain point, then government is ready to step in a sensible yet powerful way.
Would the plan entail inflation in any way?
No, the plan would not entail inflation. I may say that some folks are fearing inflation during this year. You may remember we had rather serious inflation in 1919, the first year after that war. But I don't think there's so much danger of inflation. Some things will be scarce. Sometimes I've said rather jokingly that the danger of inflation this year is a little bit like the situation that exists in a cold room when you have a big fire. And you stand in front of the fire, and you may feel rather inflated in front, but at the same time your rear is decidedly chilly. That is, you can have both inflation and deflation at the same time. I'm sure that the large segments of our population will be saying there's inflation this year. There'll be inflation during the coming year, while at the same time there's a lot of deflation. The plan itself has adequate safeguards against inflation. The danger most to be feared is deflation.
Well, does the plan demand a considerable tax revision?
Definitely. It will be vital to make such tax revisions as will most promote the maximum of investment of private capital. Obviously, the most significant tax revision that could be made would be the abrogation of the excess profits tax as soon as all possibility of inflation is passed.
Which in turn will give business some of the confidence and the courage they need to go ahead with the...
And also, within a year or two, it would be important to remove some of these so-called nuisance taxes so as to increase the purchasing power of the average consumer.
Well, coming back to the plan as a whole, the premise, as I understand it, is that all who seek work should have a right to work.
Definitely, but please remember this, that there is no insurance to any specific individual by government. Many people have urged that every individual in the United States would come around to government and say, "Where's my job?" Nothing of that sort is contemplated. What is in mind is that government should take those actions which will best promote a favorable economic climate so that all who are worthy and really want to work can find a job.
Right. In the proposed figure, 60 million, what is the approximate makeup? How many of these workers will probably be in business? How many in agriculture, in professional work, and the like?
Well, roughly the 60 million divides into two main categories, about 37 million in the fields of so-called labor, and about 23 million in agriculture, working for the various governments, federal, state, and local, and at housework, that is those who work for wages in the home, and the businessmen, roughly 6 million in the field of businessmen, professional men, or working in an executive capacity with businessmen.
Again, approximately how many in agriculture?
Or about 8 million in agriculture.
Well, that figure is rather comparable with the number we have now, and yet at the present time here in this particular section, we feel that we can use some more workers.
Well, undoubtedly there should be more workers in Iowa and in the Central Corn Belt. In those areas of the United States where the farms are rather small and the soil is rather poor, they've just had too many people living there to do the work to be done. And those people should find an outlet in industry. They can do better for themselves and better for the nation if they find jobs in town. I hope that that we have such full employment that we won't have so very many more than 8 million employed in agriculture. It'll be better for all of us.
At the same time, though, if we have full employment, we'll need more food, and I'm just raising the question now, will we be able to meet that demand with the suggested number we've given?
With the new machinery that's coming along, the new methods that are coming along, I am confident that we can produce all the food the people of the United States can eat when they're fully employed. That means they'll eat more than they've ever eaten before.
Right.
We can produce them with 8 million people. I have that much confidence in the new technologies.
And, of course, the making of the machines means more employment to more workers.
Yes. It does mean that some of the work is shifted from the farm to town.
Yes. I assume, of course, you're contemplating, though, that for youngsters, more time will be devoted to education.
Definitely. That the next generation is our most priceless asset, and we can well invest, nationally speaking, 30 or 40% more in education than we've ever invested. And I think there's a few school teachers that might well have their salaries raised a little bit.
I'm sure that statement will be a very popular one with a great many hundreds of the young ladies and others who are doing such a fine work teaching school under the obstacles they have here. And that statement you made concerning the investment in education, Mr. Wallace, I saw some of the younger generations on the other side of the Atlantic earlier this year, and I think the statement that you said nationally might also be mentioned internationally, though that's not a part of this discussion. Let me go back to the 37 million figure you suggested as a figure that will depend on jobs provided by business and industry. What is going to predicate the ability of the industrial and the business groups to provide those 37 million jobs? We've already mentioned taxes. Taxes being reduced. Now, are there other things?
Well, the all-important thing is to get the maximum investment of private capital. The tax modification is all-important. It also is important that businessmen have confidence. To that end, there should be a much greater interchange of opinion between businessmen and government, between businessmen and labor leaders. I think if we all set our hearts on the same goal, we'll get rid of a lot of this confusion and misunderstanding which seems to be in the, abroad in the land today. I've talked with a great many businessmen and a great many labor leaders in the last few months, and you find yourself in a position of sympathy with both sides, and yet feeling that there's been insufficient interchange of information between the two groups. They just don't understand each other. I feel that the Murray Full Employment Bill, together with some of the other measures sponsored by the administration, will tend to bring about a better interchange of information between these groups in the months immediately ahead. I hope so, at any rate.
Yes. Well, we're going to have to carry on rather hurriedly now on some remaining questions I have in mind. I would, though, like to ask, do you propose a guaranteed annual wage or minimum return of some kind?
Well, in many lines of business, a guaranteed annual wage would be of very great help, especially in the construction business. There are other lines of business which are seasonal in nature where it'll be impossible to have a guaranteed annual wage.
And where approximately do you think wages should seek a level at the present current rate or higher or lower?
It'll be very helpful to both the businessman and the farmer if the total payrolls of labor could be maintained pretty close to where they have been during the past year. In other words, as the hours of labor are reduced, it is important that the basic wage rate be somewhat increased. Many of the larger corporations of the country have recognized this and have increased the basic wage rate at the same time as the hours of labor have been reduced. This definitely tends to sustain farm product prices and business profits. Of course, we recognize that there are certain lines where it is impossible to maintain the payrolls, simply because the government has stepped out of the picture.
In your book, you spoke of human frontiers. I wish you'd elaborate just a little on a few of those points.
Well, I don't have time to do that, Herb, but possibly the most significant human frontier is the health frontier. About a third of us are enjoying substandard health.
Did you say enjoying?
Well, to listen to some folks, you might think they enjoyed it. But
we'd better use the term advisedly, though.
Yes, indeed. They could have health no end better. Medical service could be more available in many communities than it ever has been. Hospitals could be more available. It would be a splendid investment for the entire nation if we had more universal medical service available, more universal knowledge of dietary laws, of the use of vitamins, and so on and so on. This frontier, while it might cost several billion dollars to conquer, would increase the productivity as a result of the better health much more than that.
Well, the atomic bomb cost us some $2 billion to produce, and I'm sure that a lot of people feel that we ought to be willing to spend an equal amount, at least, for some other things that are likewise very, very important in our picture. You spoke about health. That, too, of course, would include nutrition. That is the achieving of a better standard of nutrition.
Yes, that is far more important than 99% of our people realize.
Is there a point you might wish to make about the projection of our plan into the foreign field, foreign trade, or something of that nature?
If we have real confidence with regard to peace, we can export, and if we have no economic warfare between the nations, we can find a market abroad for $10 billion worth of stuff, or $7 billion more than we had during the years immediately preceding the war. That can furnish employment perhaps to as many as 5 million people. And that's very, very significant, especially to the farmer. Many of our farm people have been dependent on the export market.
Certainly that is a substantial figure to think about. Finally, Mr. Wallace, what is a price we as a nation may expect to pay if we fail to accept the challenge before us, the challenge of achieving full employment?
But if we go down to employment like we had in 1932, the price would be very, very great indeed. Not merely in dollars, but in terms of our social structure. I can't sufficiently emphasize just what the price would be. In terms of dollars, I do know that it cost us more than $300 billion in the decade of the 30s. But the more significant cost would be in our social structure. That would be difficult indeed.
In the heartaches as well as in the dollars. Thank you 1,000 times, Secretary of Commerce Wallace. Visiting in Des Moines this week was Secretary of Commerce Henry A. Wallace, one of our own Iowa men, whom we're very proud to welcome back to the Hawkeye State whenever he finds it possible to come. He's been here for several days with his family, and we're fortunate this afternoon to have him in our studio. Mr. Wallace, in the minds of a great many of our people, the greatest challenge facing our nation is a question of full employment. Even though we must all recognize the reconversion period from war to peace is bound to cause dislocations, developments the past few weeks have made for additional concern. You, Mr. Secretary, in your interesting book, 60 Million Jobs, have awakened countless Americans to the seriousness of the challenge. We hope in this broadcast you'll feel free to make any comments you wish on the subject of full employment as you apply it to the agricultural Midwest or to the nation as a whole, for it is, of course, a national problem. My own questions will largely deal with items suggested in your 60 Million Jobs. Perhaps as logical as any way in which to open is to have you restate the goal as you see it.
What we want is continuous full employment within the framework of our democratic capitalistic system designed to ensure the maximum of free enterprise.
Well, Mr. Wallace, how does the goal, approximately 60 million jobs by 1950, compare with the highest level of employment we've known in the past?
Well, last year we had about 64 million employed, counting the boys in the armed services. In peacetime, back in 1940, we had about 46 million employed, but there were 8 million unemployed.
Actually, then, we can say that the goal we have set for 1950 shouldn't be any harder to attain than what we actually did achieve in some years in the past. Is that
right? Well, 60 million in 1950 would be proportionately no higher than the employment we had in 1929. We must remember that our population has increased considerably.
Right. Now, as to achieving the goal, just how does the challenge fit into the framework of our capitalistic system? Are we to understand by that that you believe we can achieve the end of the rainbow without substantial government assistance?
Well, Herb, I don't think we're ever going to come to the end of the rainbow.
Well, as near to it as we can, then.
But, and I don't think substantial governmental assistance is the essence of the so-called Murray Full Employment Bill. The essence is to have all the elements in our national economy focused toward the specific end, an end that'll benefit all of us, the end of full employment. That's what we want. We want the President and the Congress to focus that problem for us. We want to get as much of the problem solved by private enterprise as we can. We want the President to suggest methods as to just how the taxation system may be modified. We want the Congress to bring its full investigatory powers to bear on that problem so that the maximum of inducement can be furnished to investment capital to put people to work. Now, if that fails, then, of course, government should step in and will have to step in. Let there be no illusion about that. We know that no matter what administration may be in power, if there's any large amount of unemployment, government will step in. I think there'll be less unemployment if there is a plan of government of public works blueprinted that can be thrown into gear promptly.
And, of course, you also hope that the local governments, such as cities and municipalities, will also devise plans of their own toward the goal we're seeking.
Yes, we don't want any leaf raking again. We want projects that are really useful to people.
It's very encouraging to hear you say that, Mr. Wallace. Now, another question in that same general theme. Will the plan in any way entail inflation of some form or another?
I don't think we're in any serious danger of inflation, except possibly during the ensuing year. And even during this coming year, I think the situation is a good bit like a cold house with a big fire in the fireplace. Our front may feel a bit inflated, but our rear, at the same time, may feel in danger of deflation.
Well put.
I think there's just about as much danger of deflation this year as there is of inflation. Some areas of the economy will say there's inflation. Others will say there's serious deflation. What I'm afraid of is that the farmer may get a touch of deflation.
Well, we're all a little afraid of that, of course, particularly in this area. Does the plan demand any considerable tax revisions?
Well, you mean the Murray Bill?
Well, yes, the general plan, the goal we all have now for the larger...
Well, obviously, if we're going to have the amount of investment capital put to work to do the job, it'll be necessary to, as soon as the danger of inflation is passed, to make very radical changes in the excess profits tax legislation and other types of taxation so as to encourage the businessman to go to work furnishing jobs.
The premise, then, as I see it, is that all who seek work should have a right to work.
Yes, but the premise is not that any particular man can come to government and say, furnish me my job, I didn't get one. But it does mean that the government shall provide such a favorable climate by its overall actions that any worthy man who really wants to work can find a job. In other words, the objective is the creation of opportunity and not an absolute insurance to every individual that he'll get a job even if he's no good.
Well, now, if the achieving of a large percentage of the 60 million jobs depends on business and industry, they, of course, must thrive and prosper. What do you feel is necessary to predicate the ability of those groups to provide the additional jobs we're seeking?
Well, I think business and industry can do a real job. This is indicated by the Committee for Economic Development, which has put on a very extensive survey covering all of the manufacturing industries. That survey indicates that the manufacturing concerns have so much confidence in the future of the United States that about 55 million workers would find jobs in 1947. This does not include the men in the armed services, so there is not too great a discrepancy between the Committee for Economic Development figures based on businessmen predictions and my figures. Mind you, my figures are based on 1950, and their figures are based on 1947.
Coming to your figures or your estimates, what is the approximate makeup, shall we say, of the 60 million? You speak of the other group thinking in terms of 55 million by 1947. Now, how many of the 60 million you hope for in 1950 are men? How many are women? And have you any estimate on how many would be in agriculture or in business and some of the other walks of life?
Well, roughly, there would be about 37 million that are so-called labor. Of these, about 15 million would be in manufacturing, mining, 3 million or so in transportation, and so on. Of the 23 million, there would be roughly 8 million in agriculture and 2 million in housework, and the rest would be in working for themselves in the professions, businessmen or associated with businessmen in top positions.
The agriculture figure actually then isn't so very different from the present figure we have.
About the present figure, and considerably less than before the war.
May I ask if there's any explanation on that? Perhaps since that's a very pertinent question in this locality, we'd like to have an observation from you on that. Less in agriculture than before the war.
We don't have quite enough people on farms here in Iowa and the Central Corn Belt at the present time to do a first-class job. But in other parts of the country, there have been altogether too many people on the farms. They can do better for themselves and better for the country if they're someplace else. And it'll be a fine thing if we could find job opportunities for them in town rather than on those little farms, those poor farms, in certain areas.
Yes, we can understand that. Right here, of course, the situation, as you've stated it, is a bit on the critical side. Well, coming back to the general picture again, do you propose a sort of a guaranteed annual wage or some minimum return or something like that?
A guaranteed annual wage would be a fine thing in certain industries. Other industries, it's quite an impractical method.
What level do you feel we ought to seek to maintain wages at? A level as compared to the present, or?
It'll be a good thing for the farmer and the businessman if present income of labor can be, that is, the income of labor that was enjoyed prior to VJ Day, can be substantially maintained. Of course, no one expects it can be fully maintained. But if the cutback in hours can be compensated for by some measure of increase in the basic wage rate, it'll be definitely to the benefit of the farmer and of the businessman as well. Certain of the larger corporations appreciate this and have taken measures to increase the basic wage rate at the same time as the number of hours were cut back.
You have any thought on what the story will likely be in agriculture? Will wage rates change substantially there? Increase or decrease or be maintained?
Well, the agricultural wage rate is directly hooked up with the wage rate in the cities. If there is substantial unemployment in the cities, undoubtedly the agricultural wage rate will be reduced, and the farmer's income will be reduced at an even more rapid rate in all probability than the agricultural wage rate. So
yes.
The farmer is caught between two fires there.
That recalls the days, let's go back to 1929, when payrolls dropped so substantially from that year on to 1933, and then agricultural income also dropped drastically in that same period.
It was a pretty sad time.
Yes, I should say. Most of us remember that very well. Well, you've already told us some of the benefits that will come to farmers through the maintaining of a high wage scale and full employment. Now, shall we say just a word about the returning war veteran? After all, he is a most important segment of our population, too. How does he stand? What is his stake?
His stake is just exactly the same as everybody, as the stake of all the rest of us. There's really remarkably little difference, and that's the way most of the returning war veterans want to be treated.
In other words, we're all in the same boat.
We're all exactly in the same boat. Of course, there are certain special congressional provisions that have been made for the returning war veteran, but as I've seen them in action, they won't meet his problem unless this big problem is met.
Unless we have full employment.
That's right.
In your book, you speak of human frontiers. I wish you'd elaborate just a little on that. To me, that was very significant.
We've just begun to enable people to be healthy in this country. That's a frontier that's challenging to all of us. We all know what vitamins have done for some people. We all know of recent scientific discoveries in the field of medicine. We know that there are lots of doctors that are not to be found, that should be found out in the open country, in absence of hospitals in the open country. During the draft days, we found that there were about 4 million of the 14 million boys that were definitely substandard because they hadn't been had access to proper medical or dental service. Well, those frontiers should be conquered for the sake of giving all of us a fair and an even break. I just know no end of boys that could be full of vigor and energy going ahead that are not, simply because they haven't had their health or their diet properly taken care of.
Well, that's certainly an important point, Mr. Wallace. I see our time is slipping away very fast. There's another question or two I'd like very much to ask you, and one is concerning the matter of soil conservation. That, too, seems most important to a lot of us, and I know is close to your heart.
Well, I don't know exactly what bearing it has on 60 million jobs, but let's put it this way. 60 million jobs in and of themselves are not enough. We want to get out of 60 million jobs abundance for all of us. We want all the workers to be producing fruitfully. We want them to be in their respective fields to be working hard. Now, if the farmer producing fruitfully and working hard on the land is to furnish food at the most reasonable rates for the rest of us, then he must have the soil fertility maintained. There are literally hundreds of thousands of farmers working on farms so rolling, so eroded, so poor that they're just not doing a first-class job for themselves or for the country. Soil fertility is the very basis of our national life.
Well, Mr. Wallace, I see our time has gone away very, very fast. I wish we might have had time for more questions, but we are most grateful to you for making the points you have, and we certainly appreciate the last point you made, which is so close to the hearts of all of us here in the Middle West, just as is the important job of full employment for the entire nation.